Welcome to Read, Eat, Travel, Repeat, the book club and podcast with your hosts, Sarah, Kit, and Marianne. Three friends who talk about all things books, food, and travel.
Welcome, readers, eaters, and travelers to Read, Eat, Travel, Repeat, the podcast and book club where books take us beyond the page. I'm Sarah.
I'm Kit.
And I'm Marianne. Today we'll be talking about Come Fly With Me by Camille DeMaio. Spoiler warning for anyone who hasn't read the book yet. While we'll be giving initial thoughts and ideas, eventually we will be spoiling the end.
We will let you know when we get to that point, so feel free to listen up until then, give it a pause, and then come back once you've finished the book. Also, we have a bit of a special surprise today. The author is joining us for an interview.
I know.
That's so fun. I'm so excited.
Right?
What's going on?
I'm headed out to Wyoming tomorrow for 4 or 5 days, so that'll be super fun. And then we are back to school right after that. So we'll be diving right into, like, getting everyone where they need to go, and I'm subbing to start the year. So I'm excited about it, but it's also, like, a little bit of chaos because it'll be, like, one day in this building, one day in another building.
Yeah.
Some days I go at 7:30, some days I go at 9:15. So it'll be a little all over the map to start the year.
Okay. Well, I'm back to work after an amazing summer. I think on our last episode, I was talking about how much I love the Hudson River Valley. It was beautiful there. Mm-hmm. Our students start on Monday. We're lucky. I know all districts get this, but we get like 6 days of what we call preschool, a lot of meetings and trainings and stuff. We used to get 7, but still 6 is more than some people. Fun thing is I am starting a book club with my coworkers.
I love
this.
Yeah. So we're going to meet after school, like one Friday a month at a local pizza place. It's like the place that, like, kids go after football games and stuff. So we're going to go there, like, right after school, one Friday a month. And I'm super excited about it. So I'll be looking for book club ideas. So how about you, Kit?
I already went, so now it's your turn.
I thought you did. We're kind of mixed up today. It's okay.
Yeah, we're all over the place. It's fine.
We took a mini family vacation for 3 days to Detroit. Mm-hmm. Wonderful. You know, mostly to we had to go to campus. Kara had a job interview, and we wanted to pick up our UDM gear.
Oh, fun.
Okay. Sweatshirts and all that fun stuff. So
did you eat at Mom's Spaghetti?
We did not. We should have.
But I've eaten Mom's Spaghetti. No.
We did eat at this. We ate famous hamburgers in Dearborn, which was pretty good. And then we ate, oh my gosh, this fantastic Mexican place in Royal Oak. And I can't even think of what it's called. Something tequila, because it was all like decorated with like sugar skulls.
Ooh, okay.
That kind of feel. And they had entertainment every Tuesday and Friday, a fire eater.
Wow.
Like, we're just like eating our tacos, and I got a huge margarita flight.
Fun.
Which was great. And you don't get to choose what you get. These are what we have today for the flight, and they were delicious. So we did have good food. Just went to the zoo, just some last family time together. Mm-hmm. Family vacation. We haven't had one in a few years, and it was very needed. We played games in the hotel room and crazy stuff.
It's fun.
And now I have to deal with the car issue of my oldest daughter, who got in a car accident last week. It's fortunately fine, but I think we're gonna have to total the car out. So
yeah.
Teen cars, I tell you.
Yeah.
So living pretty boring lives right now.
Yeah, this is before school starts. Like, you nothing can tell us happening.
I haven't really done anything since the last time we talked. All right. So what about this book? How much did we love it?
Loved it.
I'm not even going to say like or hate, because I know we all loved it. So
I hated every second of it.
Well, I'll go first because, Camille had reached out to us because of the name of our platform, Read, Eat, Travel, Repeat.
Perfect.
She's like, this book really fits in with your theme there. And so she sent me a copy of the book. But what ended up happening is I was on my way to go on vacation this summer, and I had my Kindle with me, and I was like scrolling around, and it was on Kindle Unlimited. So I read it on the plane and while I was traveling. And at first, you know, at the first glance, you like read about this, you know, the life of the Pan Am stewardess. It seems so glamorous. And it's just, the book itself is like this celebration of female friendships and having confidence to escape the chains. And it was interesting too, because Judy and Beverly both were escaping from cages, yes. of two very different kinds. Yes. But then as you dug in deeper, you saw the deep-seated misogyny of the era. You see the influence of Betty Friedan and the feminine mystique, and about how in the 1950s, the ideal woman was a stay-at-home mom who cooked, you know, nutritious dinners and vacuumed in pearls. And you see that it goes along with the idea that not every woman wanted that. And that's what the feminine mystique mm-hmm. was about, right? Mm-hmm. Not every woman wanted to be a stay-at-home mom and taking care of the kids they wanted more. And this book is, you know, like this being a Pan Am stewardess was like one of the things that women could use to kind of break out of that cage. So I just really enjoyed it, especially as a history teacher. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Who wants to go next?
I'll go next. We can just go in order today.
Okay.
I, of course, put off reading this book because I was traveling. And it was totally fine because I literally read it in a day. I couldn't put it down. It was so good. Mm-hmm. I just sucked me in. I was hooked immediately. Especially because I literally started it the day I got home, and having read it just after traveling, I felt like it was really impactful. It reminded me so much of the Emirates. Is that how you say it? Emirates Airlines? Yep. Do you know how they dress? Like they all dress the same and the same color lipstick.
Oh, wow.
They do have a signature. I looked it up. I was like, because at one airport, must have been in Chicago. No, we were in Toronto and we were, delay or whatever for a couple hours. And there was a whole row of flight attendants, male and female mm-hmm. from Emirates waiting to board their next flight. And they were all like perfect, you know?
Yeah.
And I know a lot of people look at how they dress too, and just, it looks so put together with the khaki uniforms, and it made me think of that. But I love the story, love the themes, totally teared up at the end.
Yeah.
Totally teared up. I was not expecting this book to make me cry, but I definitely did. So how about you, Kit?
I loved it. Because we had already kind of gotten like some tidbits and teasers from Marianne. So I was like, what's going to happen? I loved it. I liked the way it kind of combined all the different things. So it didn't feel like it was like beating you over the head with any theme.
Right, right.
It was like you mentioned, Marianne, like it digs into the misogyny of the time, but that's not necessarily the point of the book.
Right. Oh, absolutely.
But I think sometimes that's a little more effective because you get so invested in the lives of, in this case, Judy and Beverly, and then you see it kind of through their eyes, as opposed mm-hmm. to it being like an issue book. It's really a story about friendship and these women, and you get to see it, how they experienced it, which I really liked. And I liked that we got just a little bit about each different location. Yeah. It made it really fun to kind of be like, ooh, I would want to go do that. Oh,
yeah,
I
absolutely.
Like that. Like, this is like, that would be fun. And then I think I mentioned this before. I don't want to give the spoiler, but like who the present day chapter was.
Yes.
Like, which is that, Judy or is it Beverly?
Who is this? Which one of them?
I was like digging for clues. And then I finally had to be like, you have to stop. Like, you just have to read the story and enjoy it for what it is. Eventually you're going to find out. But the first couple times we get like the present day moments, I'm like, who is it? Which person is this? I was so concerned, and then I cried at the end.
It's even one of the guys at first. Like the first one where it really didn't give a lot of information.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, is it like a husband? Is it a husband that, you know, because there wasn't a lot of information.
Yeah.
Yes.
I loved the way that those like slow rolled out where like mm-hmm. each time you got a little bit more information about whose perspective this might be from.
Yes.
I like that a lot.
So joining us today is author Camille DeMaio, whose latest book, Come Fly With Me, had us absolutely green with jealousy of all the exotic locations Beverly and Judy were jetting off to. Camille, we're so thrilled to have you with us. Can you kick things off by telling our listeners a bit about the book and what inspired you to write it?
Sure. Come Fly With Me is my eighth book. It's my seventh historical fiction. All of my other books have really distinct starting points as far as inspiration, except Come Fly With Me was somewhat organic. I love aviation. I have pilots on my family. I love Frank Sinatra. I love to travel. And so it was really a book that was born more out of a lot of my loves and also just an era that I think is so much fun. I think things kind of changed mid-60s and on. So it's early 60s is just
this era that still had a bit of innocence, but it was sort of flirting with not having it. And so there was a lot to explore. And I did have some moments that were very distinct in starting it. But yeah, it sprung from my love of aviation and all those other things.
Very cool.
Okay. Sarah, you want to ask one of the questions?
Okay. Talking about characters, Judy and Beverly come from very different worlds, but do have a lot of similarities in terms of what they want out of life. How did you come up with these two characters? Do you relate to one of them or both of them? How do they come about?
Okay. So the character of Judy came about because I learned that in 1962, you could not be married and be a stewardess for Pan Am. And I think that was true for most airlines. So the idea started to come in my brain of what if she was married and had to be looking over her shoulder the whole time, that she would be fired and wouldn't be able to be part of this dream career anymore. And she comes from small town Pennsylvania. She's in an abusive marriage, and she joins the airline to literally put miles between herself and her husband. On the other end of things, we've got Beverly, who is a New York City heiress. She grew up in a penthouse on Park Avenue. And as wonderful as that sounds, she really is in a cage of her own because there are a lot of societal expectations and her family has somebody picked out. They're kind of nudging her to marry. So she might have those posh surroundings, but really she feels like she's quite caged as well. So she does the rebellious thing and joins Pan Am against her father's wishes. And is running from something as well. So despite the fact that their lives and their backgrounds are super different, Judy and Beverly go through training together and discover a shared sisterhood, found friendship. They bond over what they're running away from and really what they're running towards. I don't lean toward being like one of them really specifically, although I will say Beverly is kind of sassy. And so I think Beverly says things that I want to say and I just keep them to myself. So through my characters, I get to sometimes do that. And for Judy, she's in Red Lion, Pennsylvania, which is a place I lived for 4 years. Oh, okay. So that small town and a bit of the mentality there is something that shaped her background for me.
Very. I like that idea of them both having their own types, different cages, but both of them.
I loved their friendship. Their friendship was like perfect to me. Like just unexpected, but also not unexpected, because people like that often do have very important characteristics in common, even though they came from two different worlds.
I love having diverse friends. I really do. And that's actually something I wanted to intentionally illuminate in there, is somebody doesn't have to be exactly like you to become a very dear friend. And that's something I try to employ in my life in a personal way. And I think that's something we could just use a lot more of in general. So I like that they have this chance to break down barriers and discover that at the heart of it, we all have the same desires of love and acceptance and individuality and dreams and so forth. I like that about historical fiction in general, honestly, even though I might be writing about eras that we haven't lived in before, or they were just simply a very long time ago. I think we're the same. The people then had the same thing, love, dreams, and so forth. So I think we can relate to that across the years, across the miles, and across fiction.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, you know, that was a perfect segue for our next question, because next question is about Ronell, about how she stepped up, that she was one of our favorite characters, and how she stepped up to help Judy, even though she didn't have to. And for anybody who hasn't read the book, Ronell is African-American, and isn't she in a biracial marriage at the time, or, you know, which is something was not the norm, actually was illegal in places still at that point. So what was the inspiration for her character?
Well, the book is set in 1962, or it starts there. And so when I write my historical fiction, I want to I want to write it in an environment that is very real for the time. And so I knew that civil rights was very big in 1962, and I wanted to look at what that might look like on the Pan Am landscape. But then I learned that in most airlines, including Pan Am, you could not be Black until the late 1960s. And so that created a little conundrum for me, because I actually had intended to write it in a more diverse way, but that also wasn't in line with what reality was for 1962. So I thought that my best nod to the era and what was going on was to still have a Black character who was the friend of Judy. And I was able to create her then to be somebody who was
really helping her out of this very difficult situation and doing all she could to save her friend's life, and really wanted to make her a hero in the story, but also a vehicle to be able to say from her own point of view why she couldn't go do this for herself. I was happy to learn, though, that biracial relationships were legal in Pennsylvania in the early 60s, which really shocked me that Pennsylvania was either the first or one of the earliest ones in there. And I was really pleased to learn that about Pennsylvania. So I got to just illuminate the time period a little bit through the character of Ronell.
That's very cool.
All right. The book covers a lot of ground, both literally and figuratively. The story, of course, balancing the history of Pan Am, lives and wants of the stewardesses, and what day-to-day life was like for women at the time. What do you hope readers take away from this story?
I hope readers take away from the story, first, that found family is such a real thing. There's just friends I've made who are as dear to me as blood, and I really like this story, so I hope they take it away. I hope that they also realize that women are so capable of so many things, and I think this era was the beginning of women really stepping out and showing all of their immense talents. And in a landscape like a Pan Am, to break out of a lot of the traditional roles of like nurse, teacher, you know, wonderful roles, but just to have more choices. And in this case, in kind of such an extreme way, to not just have another choice, but an international choice, and to go experience things that women had not gotten to experience at that level before. So I hope it just tells readers women are so capable and so talented and so filled with gifts that I just love when we get a chance to explore that.
Yeah. Same. It's kind of sad that we still have to do that today. I mean, we're both moms of daughters, so we get it. Like, we're
same.
You know, that whole like
daughters and
you can do anything. And it's like, I feel like we've been saying this for 40 years now. But
I think when you go back to historical fiction, I mean, I've been writing books that go back as like 1914 is my earliest book. I do have a sense of how far we have come as well.
Yeah,
and maybe that's the Pollyanna in me, that I do like to, I think sometimes we appreciate where we are when we can see the scope of where we've been
and then let those
inspirations shape us to move forward.
Yeah, for sure.
One of the things I have here, like on our list, it was interesting how you mentioned, and I'm assuming this is from your research, that the average time of a stewardess at Pan Am was like 18 months because they ended up leaving and getting married.
Yes.
Is that from like the research you did? You spoke to some former Pan Am stewardesses that you in your research process?
Yes, actually, that was my favorite part of writing the book. I spent several years talking with multiple Pan Am stewardesses. I ended up being their keynote for their convention a couple of years ago.
That's so cool.
Yeah,
there's several thousand of them that are really quite organized. And so they selected about five to talk to me who actually had been in that era. So now they were like in their 80s and 90s. And I did learn that at the time, because you couldn't be married, many of them did go on to marry passengers. In fact, I had a party. There was a party thrown for me in Huntington Beach in March with about 40 Pan Am stewardesses who had read the book. And while in that room, somebody asked the question, how many had married passengers? And about half of them raised their hands. So the passenger stewardess romance was a real thing, but not in a salacious way. It was actually, and this was something they were extremely serious about me covering, that it was very classy. This was not a sleep around fest, to be honest. Or as they called it, a mattress romp. And there were a lot of marriages ending in these and dating. One thing I learned in there that they wanted me to differentiate, and so I did do that in the book, is there were not pilot stewardess romances.
Oh, really?
The pilots were father figures. Many of them of that era were World War II pilots who now were married with children, and they really looked after their crew, but it was absolutely not a romantic thing. I don't think I met one stewardess pilot marriage even. But passengers, yes. And because you couldn't be married, they'd meet a passenger and the rest was history. But I like to think, though, like because flying at the time was at that level was even in business, like such a prestigious thing. It was sort of a luxury to still do it. These were men mostly who were kind of pre-screened for the women.
Right.
The women as well. Mm-hmm. To go through such a rigorous process, were also somewhat pre-screened. So when you put these people in this environment who were very accomplished, both men and women, lots of sparks flew.
Well, and the one thing I had added here, and
is I was thinking, because Kit, we were having a text conversation before as we were getting ready for the episode. And I was thinking that the women, I think, had a better sense of their own identity. Mm-hmm. So they weren't going to end up in marriages like Judy's first one, because they had a stronger sense of their own self-worth. They weren't just like stuck marrying the guy down the street, or like even for Beverly, who was expected to marry her dad's, the rich guy.
Yeah, the rich guy.
Mm-hmm. They had a better sense of their own identity, so they didn't have to quote unquote settle. They had more choices. That's what I was thinking about.
And like their identity, like you said, in the era I wrote about, it was about 1 in 50 would become the Pan Am stewardess. But depending on the hiring era, sometimes it was as many as 1 in 500 would get the job. So you ought to have a pretty good self-sense of identity if you've made that cut.
Well, and to be able to do all the things that they did in the sky in high heels and keep up the whole appearance and the weigh-ins and whatever else, you'd have to have a pretty strong sense of perseverance. And
It's funny that you say this, because I was thinking as I was reading that, and I was reading your author's note and all that, because I'm one of those nerdy readers who reads everything.
Yes.
Cover to cover.
We love that.
I always want to know what is, especially what inspired a book, and it's often in the author's note. And I remember thinking, it didn't feel like, even though so many women got married to passengers, it didn't feel like going to college in the 40s and 50s, where you went to college to get your wife degree. And so I'm glad that, I mean, I feel like your book really showcase that these women were there doing a job and they just happened to fall in love. It's coincidence. It was not.
Absolutely.
And the men didn't choose them because they were, oh, she can take care of me. It was more like, she's a strong person and she's got this amazing job. And even though that's what they did.
That was totally my experience with all the many Pan Am ladies that I met. I didn't meet one who said that she joined to find a husband.
No,
like one told me that at all. Nor did she feel like she was approached by men for anything other than, I mean, obviously they were beautiful, but their accomplishments were welcomed by the men.
Yes.
And many of them have gone on post Pan Am days to have extremely successful careers that in other fields that their husbands were completely supportive of.
Yeah.
So it really plays out. That's going back to that one question you had, I think that's an overall just thing for readers to take away too. There can be, mutual respect and support of each other's dreams can be an awesome foundation for a marriage. And I met many, many women who were part of that.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question. Are any of the stewardesses that you spoke to, are any of their stories in your book? I mean, did you take any of their stories and put them in the book?
Their personal stories, like their personalities or anything that would have been very specific to them, not so much. But loads and loads of the details come straight out of their oral histories. You know, the food service, the weigh-ins, the training, the bids for routes, the shopping. For example, what you read about in Hong Kong, about how that was a favorite destination because they could go get these custom dresses made over the course of about 3 trips to Hong Kong, absolutely came out of their experiences. Even the Hong Kong landing, the baptism for the first time.
The checkerboard landing or whatever it was called.
Yes, that was all real. So many of the details you can pretty much count on. Those were straight out of their stories. I also got a lot of celebrity stories from them. Most was quite juicy and gossipy, and I chose not to put those in there.
Right, yeah.
I didn't want to be the one to pass those along.
Right.
But I certainly got to be the recipient of some really fun stories.
Maybe ask a question, because I was thinking about Mr. Chan and the dresses, and I want to dress by him,
Right.
So my cousin and my uncle are both in the Navy. They're both pilots in the Navy. And same thing, the pilots go to Hong Kong and get their suits made. Because my cousin has a few. He's like, oh, yeah, I get a suit for like $50 and it's perfectly tailored to me. And I remember him telling me that all the time, or all things he'd buy in like Bangkok or whatever, like he just fly in for the day. And so I was like, that's not just a stewardess thing. That's like military too. They're all like, yeah, let's go to Hong Kong and get cheap suits made. And
that makes sense.
That's crazy. Yeah, that was crazy. Yeah.
Do you have any other projects coming up? Are you working on something now?
I do. I have 5 different projects I'm working on right now, which is not how I intentionally designed it. 2 of them are co-written projects. One is essentially done. It's a Christmas book, and it was written along with a producer in Hollywood who intends to make it a movie. She gave me a script and asked me to novelize it. So it's co-authored that way. And so now the ball's in her court for the next steps on that. I'm co-writing a contemporary book with one of the Pan Am stewardesses I met about a real life story.
Oh, that's so cool.
So we're fictionalizing her story for that. So we're about halfway through that one. I've got 2 historicals that are partially written that we're about to pitch to my publisher. And then while I write historical, I can't read it. So I tend to turn to romance. And so I read enough romance finally. I thought, I need to try my own. So I am writing, and this is actually a project I'm having the most fun with. I'm writing a rom-com for the first time.
Yay.
And it's pulling from some of my own history. It's 2 competing realtors.
Oh, I love that.
Nice.
Which is, I've been in that industry for 25 years. So yeah. I'm able to pull stuff, but I am having a blast with that. I could see myself taking a turn toward rom-com.
Yeah.
How fun. Now, let me go back. I have a question. How did you get into the publishing industry? Did you originally traditionally publish, or did you self-publish at first, or how did that all start?
I'm traditionally published. I don't think I knew any different. So it's kind of the result of not knowing what I didn't know at the time. I had my idea for what became The Memory of Us, and I worked on it doggedly for 6 weeks. I had my youngest was in diapers at the time, and I would drink lots of Dr. Pepper, like a good Texas girl that I was at the time, and stay up very late finishing that book. And when I was done, which is a first draft that nobody will ever, ever get to see, I didn't know how bad it was, but I just knew I'd finished a book, and I needed to look into what do I do to. I didn't even know self-publishing was a thing. So I looked into getting an agent, what it took to get an agent. That was the path I just assumed to take. And I did. And I'm very glad that I did. But it took 17 drafts and revisions to actually make it a good book.
Wow.
And I did get a chance at the end of that to give it to Paul McCartney, which is
that was one of our next questions. So yeah.
But I did get an agent from that. I had 43 rejections, though, and that's super, super average for writers. But I did know I want to traditionally publish, and I went that route. I have the same agent that I've had now for 10 years. And for me, I'm glad I did it that way.
Good. Well, that was our next question, was about Paul McCartney. How did you get to see him up close, so up close and personal, and give him your manuscript?
So at that time, I'd been working on the book for about 4 years in the sense of revising it as it needed. And it was just about done. It was pretty much a final manuscript from it. And so in San Antonio, which is where I lived at the time, there was a relatively small venue of about 1,700 people that was opening up. And somebody had the idea to pay Paul McCartney, I don't know how much money, to come and be the opening act at this small venue.
Wow.
And we learned that he had not played a venue that small. Since 10 years prior outside of Liverpool, other than in Liverpool. So it was a really, really big deal that he was there. And somebody I know who knew how much I love the song and been working on this book treated me to a front row ticket.
My gosh.
And along with my dad, my mom and dad, and my dad was he's not with us anymore, but he was my Beatles buddy. And he was so proud of this book. And my mom had the idea of bring your manuscript and hold up a sign saying you wrote a book about Eleanor Rigby, which is what the book was inspired by. And I did. And so he actually played the song Eleanor Rigby 10 feet away from me. And at the end of the song, I held up a sign and said, I wrote a book about Eleanor Rigby. And he called me up to the stage and let me give him a copy. And he even started reading it to the audience, which was really exciting.
I think I saw the video on your TikTok, or I was like, oh my God, because I'm a huge Paul McCartney fan too. So that is so cool.
Well, my brother's named Paul after him. So
oh my gosh.
That tells you anything about my family's fandom with him.
I got goosebumps over here. So, okay. So we have a few questions that we ask of every author we interview. Okay. So we'll do this one is right in line with your book. Says you've just been given a free plane ticket. Where are you going and what book are you bringing for the trip?
Oh, yeah. Wow. My husband was just asking me this last night. So I am well versed in this. I would like to go to Thailand. I've never been there. I'd like to go to Chiang Mai and see the natural beauty there, and then go to the beaches and go to animal sanctuaries. And I feel like, and I love the food already, so I feel like Thailand would have a lot of everything I'm looking for. And as far as what book, so what I tend to do on my trips, I do travel a lot. I pack a lot of thrift store books, stuff I've gotten for a dollar, sounds kind of interesting. And then I leave them behind as I go, which makes room for shopping.
I have a friend that does the same thing. Same thing. She brings a book and leaves it.
So I actually wouldn't be bringing like a book that I think I'm going to keep. I would intentionally be bringing books that I plan to leave behind. I call them my B-list books.
Yeah.
I have a little free library in my front yard now. And so I try and bring books with me so I can leave them. I go to find little free libraries in places I go to. I was in Hyde Park, New York last week. Little free library hunting up there. Okay, Sarah, you want to get the next one?
Yeah. Do you have a go-to snack when you're writing? Because we are all about food as well. So
yes.
Oh, lovely. I make myself a huge breakfast because the likelihood I'll forget to eat lunch is very high. So I start from a good breakfast. But what I end up snacking on is my husband, who knows this about me, will very often very quietly slip into my office with a little ice cream dish of charcuterie. And it's literally like it might be two slices of salami, two little dried apricots, a couple walnuts, slice of cheese. It's really tiny, but he knows I will just forget to eat, and he'll just like slip that in and walk
That's
out.
That's so cute.
So good. I love that.
So that warms my heart every time he does it. So yeah. I would say that's my favorite snack.
He knows you really well. Then yeah. To know
yes.
that you're.
Yes, yeah. He's very supportive.
Good.
That's awesome.
That's really cool.
So which book that you've already read would you sell your soul to be able to read again for the first time?
Oh gosh, what book would I love to reread again? For the first time, maybe my favorite book of all time is called Olivia and Jay. I feel like nobody's ever heard of it.
And I'm writing it down.
Olivia and Jay, J-A-I. And it's about the British Raj. So it takes place in the 1800s in Calcutta. Oh. And it's about an American girl named Olivia who goes to spend the summer with her British relatives who were in a position of power in Calcutta, and she falls in love with a man who is half Indian, half British, and has quite the chip on his shoulder about the British. So in dating her, it's kind of him putting a knife in the heart of the Brits, but in dating him, it's kind of doing the same. So it's got love, revenge, business,
nice.
It's epic, it's got royalty, it's awesome. All the things, and I would love to read that with fresh eyes.
Well, that's very cool. We love getting recommendations from the authors we talked to.
We've got some really good ones too.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
We're like, oh, this is a great book.
So I don't know if this one applies to you so much because it maybe, I don't know. We'll see. The last author we interviewed was Ivy Fairbanks, who wrote a book called Morbidly Yours about an Irish undertaker. So she had, this is more applicable to her, but if the FBI searched your computer history while you're writing and researching your book, what term or phrase would be the most questionable?
I think about that once in a while because I hear other authors talk about it, but really not. They would find a whole lot of, like, recently at least, travel-related
right.
things. Mm-hmm. My search history was definitely shrouded with that. Probably for Comply With Me, they would find like how to get a Mexican divorce or something. So I think I'd be a little more afraid of my husband finding my search history than the FBI. Like, why are you reading so much about a divorce? But that obviously was a big part of Comply With Me's story. So I did a lot of research on Mexican divorce.
Yeah. Ivy's book had, because he was an undertaker, she had like search histories about like embalming and things like that. So
my favorite author is Agatha Christie. And so I can only imagine if she had lived in the era.
Yes,
yes. Histories. Like, I can't even.
I also love Agatha Christie. One of my favorites.
Yes.
Yeah. What are you currently reading?
I just finished, like, literally right before we started. So it was a good deadline. It's called Darling Beasts by Michelle Gabel. Michelle has written a lot of New York Times bestselling historical fiction, and this is like a super wacky, can't just compare it to anything else book, that she just decided to have a lot of fun doing something contemporary with a touch of magical realism. So I just finished
it. I love
it.
That.
It was very like family saga and magical realism and wild animals appear out of nowhere. I have to ask her like where she got this idea.
Where she got this idea.
I don't know. But it was so different from anything else I've ever read. And I think it was just nice to read something that fresh.
Yeah. Yeah. Very cool. I will say, Camille, because like I said, I read all the author's notes and everything. And I marked down here is one of the things I loved that you said, only because it not only relates to me, relates to this whole podcast in general. You said, travel is a great educator, but more so are books. I'm thankful to the many historical fiction authors who have transported me to other times and places all my life. And I'm grateful for the opportunity to contribute to the genre.
Yes.
And I love that, because that our whole like kind of premise is the books make us want to travel. That's where we came up with the travel part, that we read about places we want to go to, even if they're fictional. You know, even if it's a mythical land, you're like, I wish I could be here. And some of us are lucky enough that we get to travel. And mm-hmm.
And we don't tell my husband how many of our trips have been
because of books.
Yeah, I get to write them off. When I travel now, I get to call
it. I know.
That's what we're looking for.
We're hoping to, like, for the podcast. Can I start writing this off?
Never be far from that. So I really enjoy that. But yeah, whether it's travel related or historical fiction, which you're just traveling to another era, I just think books are, they're the best. I feel like I really couldn't, I'm one of those people who I could easily, I'm very personable, I think, but I could easily enclose myself in a room with books for the rest of my life and never talk to anybody and just read.
Same. And just,
be quite happy with that. It's what I've loved about Book Talk. I've been on Instagram for a very long time. I love it as a platform, but I came onto Book Talk in January and I really feel like I'm finding my people there.
Okay.
Even more so than I'm finding a lot of friends in Instagram, but I'm finding like my people in Book Talk,
which are like,
I will eat, drink, sleep, smell, whatever.
Yes, I know. And they're so excited about everything. Every book. There's not, they're
it
not
is
like.
Crazy. If you could see what I'm surrounded by right now, my husband asked if I had an obsession recently. I was like, no, it's books. There's no such thing as when it comes to books, but it's a lot.
I've started collecting different versions of certain books that I really love that I will never read. I bought a copy of Fourth Wing in France, in French. I do not speak French. Nice. I will never read it, but it looks really cool.
I love that about my own.
With the collection.
So I got a shelf, that I'm trying to do this backwards. That whole shelf is all my books plus my foreign translations.
Yes. Oh,
and one of them is in Farsi. And I love that because it's one of those that goes back to front and to left. And the letters are all different.
They're beautiful too, to see them in other languages and
it is
things like that. I love it. But I just got back from a big trip and as I was finishing the book, I was thinking, I think I texted this morning. I said, I'm really glad that I read this after I came back because I am a nervous flyer. I love to fly, but I don't. Like I get really withdrawn the couple days beforehand. And I get really inside my head and I'm fine once I'm on the plane, but I don't like to hear the negative stuff. I was like, so glad I'm already been home from my 9-hour flight from Europe because I probably would have been like,
I'm with you. As much as I love aviation, I don't like to fly. And that always amused the Pan Am stewardesses who do so much. I'm like, I actually hate flying, but I love travel and I love aviation. And I want to be near all the aviation. I just don't want to be in it, but I need to be in it to do the travel. So I do.
That's the same. I was like, if I want to leave this continent, I have to fly.
Yeah.
I'm not ready to take a 3-week boat across the Atlantic to go to Europe. I have to fly there.
It's a 1 week. I've done 1 week one week back.
Oh, geez.
I have done that before. I would rather do that than fly.
Yeah.
Really? Oh, no.
But.
No, Sarah. Yeah,
I would really like to just teleport like in Star Trek.
Oh, yes.
When that happens, I will be very happy.
Well, Sarah, remember, I didn't.
But I do have a daughter about to move to Italy. I have one in New York. I have one in Nashville. So I have lots of.
You have reasons to travel. Where in Italy is she moving?
Rome.
Oh, nice.
Rome. Yeah. In 3 weeks. But yeah,
there's a lot of history you can get in there. You can start writing the whole about.
You need to book some research trips. You know,
I do need to book some research trips. I am thinking hard definitely. About the win on that.
Mm-hmm. Well, Sarah, I was going to say, remember when I met you up in Chicago? It was the first time I'd flown 14 years, I think it was.
Wow.
Because I did not fly when we met. Yeah.
Yeah. I'd freaked out after 9/11. Mm-hmm. Because I'd been at the World Trade Center like a month before it came down. And that just was like, well, I don't really want to be on planes if they're mm-hmm. flying into buildings. But now yeah.
She goes everywhere. Like she's spending her, but I think of that. I was like, when we came up to do ALA, you were like, I'm getting on a plane because I have to do this. I can't travel That's anywhere else if I don't just get on a plane and go. And
I have my friend Xanax now. So
yeah,
we travel well together.
Where do you each live?
Michigan.
Okay.
And Marianne's in Florida and Kit's in Colorado. We're all over. So,
hey, I grew up in Denver and I'm going to go to a conference in Michigan next year. It'll be my first time in Minnesota.
Yeah, we're all kind of all over, but so we do have to travel to see each other.
And it's good. I mean, it's good though, too, because we all have different perspectives. We all have different genres that we like. So it kind of all works together. So.
Well, like you were talking about Friends, that I think if you put the three of us in a room and people would look at us and be like, why are you guys such good friends? We're different ages. We were drawn together by books, and then we found other things that we like, just like the characters.
Agree.
People that you wouldn't normally think would be friends, and then you're like, wow, you guys are like best friends. I'm like, yeah, we are.
Yeah, I'm totally the same way. And I think books are a huge unifier. I mean, some of my writing friends could not be more different from me in every way possible. And they are my dearest, dearest friends. And we bond over writing and books. And I think we can just really transcend all the other stuff when we find this.
Sarah and I have known each other for 17 years?
Yeah, I think we decided that. Yeah.
I don't know if you remember, like during the Twilight phenomenon, we were Twilight moms. Some of us don't judge us.
No.
Sarah
Twilight is why I'm a writer. But
really? That's so cool.
Finish your story first. Now I feel like
we were Twilight moms, and then we became moderators of their Book of the Month Club section. And so we used to have book discussions. I don't even know what technology we used back then.
We just chatted. We literally did a chat room.
Yeah.
With authors, because authors would come join us too. And it was so like,
and then
weird.
That evolved. The people who ran Twilight Moms created like a spinoff.
I was like, okay. Yes. Yeah,
I was thinking a shoot off, and I'm like, no, that's not it.
Yeah.
A spinoff called Eve's Fan Garden, like the things that tempt you. And so same thing, we used to do live author chats and book reviews, and then life kind of got in the way and we were missing it. So that's why we restarted this year with Read, Eat, Travel, Repeat. So
good. Welcome back.
Yeah. So we all met online too. That's the other weird thing.
Oh, that's great.
We have all met. Like we've gone on trips together. Yeah.
And we've gone to the ALA conference. What was the other one we went? Was that the one we went to in Florida, or is that the one? We went to one in Florida and
we went to NCTE in Florida when it was at Disney.
That's what it was. Okay. And then you and I went to ALA in Chicago.
Chicago. Nice. And then Marianne wanted to start running. And so she got Kit and I to run. And then we ran a half marathon together.
Yes.
Oh, wow.
I love how books. And then Marianne's knees are really bad now. So Marianne has a tricycle now. So
I've had a knee replacement. So there's no more running for me either.
Yeah, I've heard that can be pretty hard on you.
So tell us the Twilight thing.
Yeah, so I wanted to be a writer ever since I was 12. And I just thought it was something, once I became an adult and had my careers and everything, I thought it was something I would do after I had after my children were grown. I ended up having four children and a real estate career, and I thought I'll do this someday. And then my preteens wanted to read Twilight. And so I thought, well, they're a little young. Let me pre-read it for them and see what I think. And I got through all four books in 3 days. So you can kind of tell what I thought about.
Same.
Okay.
Same. So I ignored the family in the name of I'm screaming it for you.
But then I went down the rabbit hole and I looked up some quotes and things on Stephanie Meyer's website. And I learned two things that from her that became really pivotal to me writing now. One was which she didn't write linearly. And I had this idea for a book that became The Memory of Us. But I had a scene that came through about three quarters of the way in, but I wasn't there yet. And yet it's the scene I really wanted to write. And her saying that she would write as she was inspired and then paste it together, gave me the freedom to just start writing the thing I was actually most strongly feeling. And that opened some things up. But the other thing she said is that she wrote her books at swim team practice with her three kids. And we did swim team. And I thought, oh, my gosh, I can write during swim team. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so literally that was like the permission I needed to say I can write while I have four small children at home. And so 8 books later, thank you, Stephanie Myers.
Yay, we love that. That's amazing.
Tell my students that all the time. I'm like, you know, Stephanie Meyer started that book with the meadow scene. She had a dream and exactly. She woke up and she wrote the meadow. And you know what? The finished product, you don't know that. Because I get kids, of course, I teach English and they're like, I don't know where to start. And I go, so start at the end, start in the middle. Do you know what you want to say for your conclusion? Like what's your big sentence that you want to tie it all together? Do that. And then go back to the beginning.
I'm glad like, you see that.
It's
nobody
okay.
Ever says that.
Yeah, I said, you always see the finished product. You'd never know how many drafts a book took. You never know what order it was written in. You just see the finished product. And that's all I'm grading, essentially.
Yeah.
I grade your process. Did you do it? But also, how did it go in the end? So
well, I hope you end up in a lot of book acknowledgments someday, because
I hope so.
Lost it for me.
And it's funny, as my intro to Twilight was also kid related, because I'm a history and government teacher. And I saw a student carrying a copy of Twilight, and I asked her about it. And she's like, oh, it's the best book And so I went and got a copy out of our school library and like devoured it. And same thing, kind of went down the rabbit hole and read all the books and looked at all the fandoms and found Twilight Moms. And I think I'm the only one of the three of us who actually has been to Forks. Yeah. Kit and Sarah.
Yeah, Kit hasn't. You've been to Forks too? I know. I need to
go. Yes, I'm in.
My parents have been to Forks. I'm like,
you know, and also it seems like Twilight's kind of making a comeback, because I see some of my students reading it. It's so retro. We all reread it for our first podcast episode. And like,
you know,
Bella has a dial-up modem in her.
Oh my God. Yeah, I'm definitely due for a reread. I loved Midnight Sun, though. And I really liked Midnight Sun when it was just a draft that she ended up getting online. So you guys know that story. And so when she published it, I was like, I bought that, obviously. And that's actually my favorite.
Yeah, I think it's better than Twilight. Yeah.
I think it is, too.
It really is. Well, she also had how many books under her belt by that time, too, that she had the ability to edit it and, you know, see her flaws the first time.
Yeah, all get a little better in time.
I just, Edward's, his point of view is more interesting. I used to teach Twilight, actually, at my old school.
Nice.
And I would teach the first chapter of Midnight Sun, the illegal one. Well, not illegal, because she put it out on her on her page, and I was like, I can teach the first chapter. And I get all the girls, and they're like, you know, Bella's like, oh my God, Edward, like, does my hair smell? Why does he not look at me? And I'm like, and then you read Edward's point of view, and he's like, how long will it take me to rip out the throats of these 27 children before I can eat her? And they're like, that is so cool. So I'm like, point of view matters, guys. Like, who's going to tell your story? Who's the person?
That was so good.
And they're like, this is so good. Keep going. Yeah. I'm like, sorry, we don't have the full book, but...
I love that. So, you guys get it.
So, you have any parting words, any other things you want to tell us other than go buy your book?
Always, you know, go buy the books. That's how we get to keep doing it. Thank you. And, you know, tell your friends, review all the things, not just for my book, but for any books. You know, there's so many ways to support authors, which is getting harder and harder with AI coming up so much and AI written books. So support the human authors. Maybe I need a bumper sticker for that. And the only other two things I just try to say is, for anybody out there who is an aspiring writer, I just want to say, I think there's two virtues to really hone. It's persistence and humility. And so persistence will push past all the no's until you get your yeses. And humility gives you the opportunity to receive honest critique and make your work even better. I see a lot of people who dig in and say, this is my art, nobody's changing it, and they're not going to go anywhere. So I just encourage writers to cultivate persistence and humility, because you're going to need them in spades in this.
I love that. I love that.
It's very true.
Yeah,
it's a good life skill. You need that in life.
Like, oh, yeah. You need it in life anyway. Definitely. And also, I just love to keep in touch. So I'm on Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube.
Yeah, for sure.
And a lot of people have asked me if I'm doing a sequel for Comply With Me. And I've never done a sequel, but I am going to be writing some one-off chapters about Judy and Beverly in different travel locations. So I have a lot of places I've been that didn't make their way in the book.
Yeah.
And a lot of people have asked for more Judy and Beverly. So I'm just going to do these individual things about, I'm kind of playing with the first one being Istanbul, which is where I honeymooned. And so the way to get those, they're going to be free, is just through my newsletter, which is on website, CamilleDeMayoAuthor.com. And when somebody signs up for my newsletter, that will be the vehicle that I send out more Beverly and Judy stories.
Well, All
right. Camille, we want to thank you so much for joining us today and talking about your book, Come Fly With Me. If you have not read it already, you need to do so right away and then come back and listen to the rest of the podcast. So thanks a lot for coming.
Thanks for having me.
Awesome. Wow, great conversation with Camille. Now it's time for us to get back to talking with just the three of us. How about those plot points? We're talking about the misogyny. Our first plot point, just the whole idea of taking control of your life.
Yes.
And I was thinking of this, Ma, when you were talking about the misogyny, like it was two different types of misogyny, mm-hmm. really, because it's one with the whole, you're rich and you need to be a trophy wife.
Right.
And the other with, you're a wife and you need to shut up and take it.
Right. Yeah. Right. Well, absolutely.
And, even, and it just different, slightly different, you know, taking control of their lives and what they were living and how they were being controlled by men in two different ways.
And then you get into like the more like casual misogyny, maybe of like, you're a stewardess and this is a huge opportunity.
Yeah.
And you're doing this big independent thing where not a lot of people get to do it. Like, you have to pass some serious criteria to even get the shot at it. And then you do it. And
the one thing I would say, for many of them, their goal was bigger aspirations than maybe in their small town, especially for Judy. Mm-hmm. You know, that she had, it gave these women so much more opportunity not to just settle down with the boy next door and go on living your life, that you're meeting men who were wealthy and accomplished. Because, I mean, travel wasn't something that everybody did. So it still was giving them more opportunities than they would have had if they, you know, stayed at home, became a teacher or a nurse, which were the like traditional occupations for women. So it was still expanding it that way.
Yeah. I like to think too that the men were more respectful of a woman working as well.
Right.
Because they met her working. Like, that's
what
she was doing, even though Pan Am would not allow them to be
to continue married, working.
But a lot of these women, they all went on to do other things. Many of them really great things. So they weren't like, it's not like I'm seeking a husband so I don't have to do anything. It was like, the bonus of this job is I met somebody who respects me and respects my intellect. And now I'm going on and I'm doing something else.
And they got that taste of freedom and probably didn't want to give it up completely.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I see we have this question on here because this is what we're talking about right now. Do you think having had the experience gave them more confidence in the long run and therefore less likely to end up in a marriage like Judy's?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think so.
And
it also, beyond the more experience and confidence, it gave them places to go. Like, it got Judy out of the town, out of the situation. And she has contacts in multiple places now that if she needs to get out, she can go.
She could. Yeah. Well, we talked about this last time on our last podcast, the thrill and the confidence build you get from traveling alone.
Yes.
And even though they're with other people, they're not with their family members or their spouse or their, it's still traveling by yourself and just knowing you can do it, knowing you can do it by yourself, how amazing that is.
Absolutely.
Yeah. What else do we have here?
We've got finding family, families. I think that obviously that was huge for both Judy and Beverly, like just finding each other, but also having the whole team of stewardesses behind them, like the whole Pan Am company. Yeah. And then I love Ronell.
I do too.
Like, she was just being able to knowing that she's doing something that Henry is going to hate and possibly take retribution or revenge on her and still going, nope, we're doing this. Like, I got your back. Let's do this thing.
Well, and I think that too, I mean, that's kind of a metaphor too for the fact that, you know, she was in a biracial marriage.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so she was probably used to being, you know, bullied. Mm-hmm. So, you know, to me, when you're somebody who's experiencing somebody being bullied. You don't want to see someone else being bullied.
Yeah. Like you're more sensitive to that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But you want to look out for people who are in really tougher situations, because Ronelle was at least living her life. She wasn't, you know.
Yeah. She was safe in her own home.
She was safe. Yeah. Whereas Judy was not.
Yeah. And Ronelle's husband was super supportive. You know, you really don't see him a lot. But he was pretty supportive. He was pretty supportive of what Ronelle was doing with Judy, how she was helping her. Yeah. He could have been like, hey, this is dangerous.
None of your business. He was like, stay out of it.
He was along for it too. Like, you're right. Everyone deserves to have what we have.
And right.
We need to help her.
And he's one somebody who was thinking outside the box at, you know, of that time period, that he was, you know, willing to marry someone who his family, his friends, his neighbors were probably not going to accept.
Right.
But you know, so he was somebody who was already thinking outside the box.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
So when do we want to do our spoiler alert? Should we do it now?
That's what I was just thinking about. Like, I'm looking at the next questions. Like, are we, what are we going to get into?
Yeah.
Probably now. Yeah. Now is probably the moment for spoilers.
Ding, ding, ding. Spoiler alert.
Yeah, we need like a little like spoiler alert alarm. Like, and now is your moment to pause and come back.
Mm-hmm.
At whatever minute this is, take a gander, see what the time stamp is on it.
Right.
Come back. When you're done reading.
If you don't want us to spoil it for you.
If you don't care about spoilers.
Or spoil a little, yeah. I mean.
Come along for the ride.
Yeah. Okay. There's your warning. So.
That's it. The warning.
The whole concept of covering up bruises and the scars of life, both metaphorically and physically.
This is a very deep question. I don't know if you put it on there. We're getting serious.
I think it might have been me because I had just read. I literally, as soon as I read, I was like, I got to write all my notes down right now because I have so many thoughts.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was just thinking about it. It's not just Judy and Beverly, but also Beverly's mother.
Yeah.
Yes. You know, that she was actually a Filipino bride and she's had to cover that up all of her life to fit in with this New York society. And I thought that was just a really interesting kind of subplot in there that,
right.
You know, that she also had to do this. And also,
and that was another spot that I liked that I think this whole book for me was like the slow rolling of information.
Yes.
You're just like constantly revealing like little bits of new information that you can piece together. So even just like because when you first meet Beverly, you're like, in my mind, at least, I was like, oh, she's kind of like, you know, the Upper East Side Gossip Girl kind of person. Like, her dad's big money. Mom is very, like, keeping up with the Joneses and this, that, the other. And then, you know, they, for lack of a better way of putting it, like, they slum it down to, like, the hair, like, to the bad side of town to get their hair done. And then you learn a little bit more. And you're like, no, that's the mom's way of trying to stay connected to her family. But at the outset, you're like, what a weird place for them to go get their hair cut. Like, I wonder why what's the catch there?
But I think that still happens, though.
I think so, too.
There's a lot of around us, a lot of Vietnamese nail places.
Yeah.
And it's not just people like me going to get their nails done. It's pretty uppity area. Yeah. And instead of going to the spa to get them done.
Right.
Because sometimes I think those people want to think they're better than the person.
Right.
You know, and I just had
this. And I like how hers was different. Hers was, like you said, to stay connected to her family.
I just had this kind of interesting deep thought. Okay, so when Beverly went to her, we end up finding out is her aunt, right? It was Sammy was her name, right?
Yeah.
Okay, she was related.
Yes.
Okay.
I'm forgetting the exact relation, but yes.
And she ate rambutan flavored candies.
Yes.
When she was there.
Yep.
Okay. So I was at Trader Joe's a couple weeks ago and they had those rambutans. Okay. And I bought them and I literally had to Google how to eat them because they have this spiky outside and then like kind of this shell and you have to kind of score the shell and then open it up and then there's like a sweet fruit inside.
Okay.
And I was just thinking that's kind of a metaphor for Beverly's mother, that she's spiky on the outside.
Spiky on the outside.
And as the book goes through, we find out that she actually does have a sweeter center than any of us would have guessed at the beginning, you know? So I was just thinking that connection there.
They actually carry those at my grocery store too.
Do they really?
My area. Yeah.
We have not great grocery stores here.
Took a picture of it and I was like, oh,
I tried.
Meijer is like what everyone talks about in Michigan.
I tried a few and then I was too lazy to eat more of them.
Because
it also has like a big pit in the middle. So it's like you open this thing up. You have to use a knife to open it up, basically. And then it's like eating a grape with a giant seed in it. So
I'll just
buy seedless grape. Because it kind of tasted grape flavored to me. So
it
was like,
but it would make sense if it's a flavor. If it's something that, I mean, they weren't eating the fruit all the time. They were eating flavored candies or whatever.
Yeah, no, but I was just thinking about that kind of connection with Beverly's mother, that she's spiky on the outside, you know, but when Beverly gets under her skin, she finds that there's a lot of sweetness down there.
Yep.
Yeah.
I had highlighted a quote in regards to this. I don't remember who said it. I didn't write down who said it, if it was Judy or Beverly. I think it was Judy. I'm learning that people present a facade to conceal the wounds they are not yet ready to share.
Yeah.
Which really resonates with both women because like you said, going back to Beverly's mom, same thing. She's concealing, she's puts on that facade to conceal those wounds. But that goes back to that scarring that everyone kind of, you know, you hide a little bit of yourself if you are not ready for people to see.
If you're not sure about the people, if it's new, you're in a new place for sure.
Yes. Yeah. And you're like, and so I think it's Judy that said that because I think she started to think that she was the only one that had
like
these
secret.
Scars she was hiding in the secrets. And then she realized that there were other people around that maybe they're hiding something as well.
Well, this kind of ties into the quote that I have here that we talked about, like in Morbidly Yours, we talked about how some people have that intuitive ability to recognize grief. And it says, Mr. Chan nods and doesn't challenge my strange request. Maybe he just wants to sail, or maybe he knows enough about the human soul to recognize one that is wounded. Mm-hmm. I sense he has the same intuitive qualities that bartenders and hairdressers have when working with their patrons. That same idea of recognizing grief and knowing how to deal with it, how to help people, you know, just because that's the thing to do.
Ironic that he says hairdressers.
Yes.
I think it was her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I think this is, isn't this Judy saying this
I think
quote?
It is Judy.
I think it's
yes.
Judy. So just that the fact that Sammy is a hairdresser.
Yeah.
The same kind of, I mean,
and she doesn't probably, know that, probably
it's my English brain looking way into it, but
yeah,
I think that authors subliminally leave messages that they probably don't even realize.
I would agree. Yes.
So.
I'm like reading through all these quotes. Like, I feel like it's been so long since I read this book and it really hasn't, but I was like, Oh yeah. Well, I thought the one that I put on there, which right after that, the made me think of our discussion with Summer in the City on money. I've realized that riches are their own kind of poverty. Certainly material needs are met with an ease that others struggle for. But inside, in the soul, there's a restlessness for more that can never be achieved because it's impossible to have it all. There's always something more to acquire, something newer, someone with an even grander fortune.
Yeah.
And that made us think about when we were talking about Summer in the City, how... I'm going to blank on the main character's name from that book, but like she has the money.
I just finished listening to it yesterday.
To not have the money.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And both are a bit of a curse.
Yeah. And that's where we're talking about those cages. That Judy's cage, Beverly's cages were very different. Judy's was very, you know, Beverly's was very gilded, you know, but it was still a cage.
Yes.
Yeah. Going back to the found family too, I mean, we're kind of mixing our talking point with our quotes, but it kind of like, it makes sense. The two quotes that go together, the love of a good man is a sacred thing, but the love of a good friend, maybe even more so.
Yep.
I mean, that's the whole, like you're talking your husband, a good man, that's your family, but she's saying a friend, maybe even more.
Right.
And then I love the next one, I declare you and I should spend the rest of our lives planning one trip a year, girls only. Mm-hmm. Husbands and babies are all well and good, but there's nothing that replaces the unique comfort that is found in the company of a friend.
Yeah.
Yes.
which is such a great quote until the mm-hmm. end. And you're like, oh, no.
I know.
But at the same time, they did take trips.
They did. But at the same time, I mean, that's like the ultimate sacrifice that your friend could do for you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, my gosh.
Literally. I mean, that's like a whole conversation.
Yes.
Yes.
To be had.
Yes.
Yes.
Which we can get into now if we want to. But that choice that she makes.
I know.
Big spoilers there. Big spoilers. Well,
because I feel like we've covered up most of those, like, those plot points.
Yeah.
About the women and society and their roles and everything. And
just how it's the whole book is like just such a tribute to female friendships too, you know?
So. Yes. Yes.
But
and the found family, like you said, I feel like it's finding your own way. So to speak, and that's okay.
So the end part, when we find out who is the present day person, I was conflicted over whether or not I was happy with which one it was. But the more I think about it, the more I think I'm happy with it. I was more okay
because I wanted
Judy to live. Yes.
Live with a capital L, because I felt like she had that taken from her, and Beverly had a really nice life growing up and all
she
of that.
She didn't necessarily have like the love or affection of her dad, but she had her guy.
She did have love though in the end.
Yes.
Like she did meet somebody.
Yes.
I'll tell you what was happening is I was reading and I was getting where it was going.
Yeah.
Like there's a thunderstorm coming in. I was like, no, no plane crashes. No.
And then
I'm sitting here and I'm going, oh my God, Pan Am flight. There's Pan Am flight. And so I'm Googling.
Yep.
Pan Am flights that crashed.
Oh my God.
So awful.
Yeah.
The fact that, and I know Camille said this, how her choosing where to have everything take place. And then it literally her timeline fit perfectly with this crash. And it is like one of the only times that Pan Am flew
domestic continentally.
Yeah. Yeah. Like she said, those stops never happened. Like that's a really rare stop for them to do. And that's the one time. And I was just like, oh, yeah. I liked how when you're reading it and they talked a few chapters in, it was like talking about spreading her ashes.
Yeah.
And so it put the notion of a crash out of my head, because I was like, you wouldn't have anything left. And then I think right before the chapter with the crash, it was like, I have something, even though there's nothing left of you. And I was like, oh my God, it's a crash. She's going to die in a crash.
I didn't even think about that. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm a nervous flyer. So I think of things like that, like randomly,
but I anticipated a crash
from the beginning.
Oh, one of them is gonna be on a plane and it's gonna crash.
It never even dawned on me. I was thinking cancer or old age or something. Yeah.
I just thought this book's
about to devastate us. Like I was waiting for this to happen.
I was waiting for the happily ever after. Like they both met their men and they would retire at 18 months.
Yeah.
With the airline and go on and have babies, and or even at the beginning, knowing one was gone, I thought, oh, it's an old age, or I thought it was one of them with their husband. Their husband had died, and that's what they were thinking of, or this husband that they met. Like, because at first you're not, you know, it takes a few chapters for their friendship to develop.
Right.
You get their individual chapters, and then you're like, how are they going to cross? They don't cross paths until really the training. I mean, they barely kind of cross paths in New York or wherever they do their interviews. But other than that.
And you never think they're going to be friends because they seem so different.
Yep.
I mean, because Judy gets down there with like no clothes, you know, other than basically the clothes on her back. And, you know, Beverly's got whatever she wants. And
No, I figured once I saw the two points of view, I was like, one of these ladies is going to bite it. And I'm going to be real pissed off about it. But it is the, I think I've mentioned it before with other books. I can't remember which one, but there was a blogger forever ago, not even a book blogger, she does movies and stuff, that was getting like people were on her case for liking a movie that had kind of a sad ending. And she's like, that's not the movie's job isn't to give you the happy ending you want.
Yeah.
It's to give you the ending you need.
Right.
This is the ending that the character needs. It's the ending that the reader needs, in this case for the book, or like the watcher needs for a movie. And I was like, I don't love this ending because like, was it necessary?
Yeah.
But I do think it does. I think I would have liked it less if it wasn't a real plane crash. Like the fact that this was a real plane
really
crash
existed.
That happened.
Yes. Yes.
She didn't just kill her for the sake of killing.
No,
exactly.
Or create a plane crash that didn't.
Right. Exactly.
You're like come on, you're using real names and everything, or you know, real airline. You can't just like.
Yeah. So I don't want to say I liked it, but like I appreciated the fact that it was like grounded in reality. I was like, okay, like I don't want her to die, but like it does fit.
It
the
makes
narrative.
Sense and it fits. Yeah.
If it's
and there's
the
a
timeline.
There's a big difference between when you gratuitously kill somebody off that doesn't need to be. I didn't feel like she was trying to get a reaction.
Yeah, I didn't feel that way with this. So I was prepared to be really, really like, but why did you do? And then I was like, oh, like, that I don't like it, but I love it. If that makes,
yeah.
I was like, no, but also like everything about it fit together and made sense as part of the story.
I was just thinking of a quote I read years and years ago from like some motivational speaker, and it's about how the amount of the reward is proportionate to the amount of risk involved.
Yeah.
Okay. And so like, it kind of leaves you with that idea that like the reward, even for like Judy going on, continuing on without Beverly.
Yeah.
She, in order to get the reward that she's gotten, she has to still be willing to take risk.
Yes.
Yes.
You know, so, and the motivational speaker was talking about why brain surgeons make more than, you know, teachers, because they literally have somebody's life in their hands.
Yeah.
You know, so, but yeah, just, I think that ties in here too, that we see that, yes, this is a beautiful, glamorous life, but there's still risk involved in it.
Mm-hmm.
But think of what they got out of it beforehand.
Mm-hmm. And I think for Beverly, not that she was terribly selfish to begin with, but it's her character arc of like being fully giving.
Yes.
Caring about somebody enough to say, I have to get this woman away from her husband. And I have to say, I'm going to get on this plane and you won't.
And
that's not something I think she would have done 6 months prior.
And the thinking too is, you know, we're talking about found family, but she literally found family in Hawaii.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, once
and
she
I'm
found
glad
out.
She got that. Yeah.
I forgot about that whole part. I loved that too.
Yes. Her, you know, so she found her roots. She found that sweet center of her mom.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. You know, so she had, you know, she changed a lot from the Beverly we met at the beginning. So
and I liked. It's like a very small thing of her meeting her family there, but them kind of like immediately kind of like, you know, ribbing her, like kind of like, oh, you dressed up today.
Yeah.
And she's like,
But that's a kind of family that she had never had the opportunity to have.
Yes.
That kind of just like, come as you are, like, we're going to tease you about it, but like, we love you already. Mm-hmm. Like that was new for her. And I liked that was included.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So we have a bunch of quotes here we haven't even talked about yet that I think we should, because I was looking over and I'm like, oh, they're so good. So from Judy to Beverly, it's not that a woman can't hang her happiness on a man, a bad one or a good one. She has to make her own happiness.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I love that too, because that, and of course, coming from Judy saying this to Beverly.
Like she's had her moment to realize that like I was.
And I'm not saying you can't love someone.
Right.
It's not saying boys are bad, stay away,
right.
Boys have cooties. It's like, no, but they're not what makes you happy. You can't be happy with a man until you're happy with yourself, which of course we all know is true.
Right.
We kind of talked about this one too. The single successful businessmen know there's no better place to meet a beautiful, intelligent, worldly woman than right here on a Pan Am aircraft.
Yeah.
Why some of them take trips just to the hopes of meeting their missus.
Can you imagine, like, you have so much money that you're like now everyone uses dating apps.
Right.
But like,
I'm going to book a flight across the world and meet my wife.
Yeah. I'm going to book a flight across the world so I can maybe find my future bride here on the Pan Am flight.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm trying to figure out who says this quote about "I've seen so much in my life." Is that?
I'm thinking it's got to be Judy.
I think it's Judy in one of the like current day sections.
Her current day, where yeah. She's thinking kinda, on her life.
Yeah, she's reminiscing on like her choices and where she's at. Because there, I think it's in the section where she's talking about like her.
It is her. I just checked it in the book.
Checked it. Yeah. So read it. You should tell us what it is because only I can read it.
Okay. Yeah. So I've seen much in my life, traveled to remote countries, met fascinating people, eaten exceptional food. And yet I've learned that while those moments are enviable, a life of simplicity surrounded by the ones I love is the greatest luxury imaginable. You know, so I think the fact that Beverly ends up dying so that Judy can live. I mean, I feel like this is almost like a tribute to Beverly, that she was that loved one that was more important than all these other material things, travel and food, that people that you love are what count.
Yeah. I know the three of us talked about it. I think I cut it out of our last podcast, to be honest, because this conversation got like so long and I was like, it's really more relevant to this, but how I had said too, and there's another quote down here further. Interestingly, by expanding my world, I've come to appreciate the small spaces in it. Cause we had talked about, I said, I feel like for me traveling that when I do come home, I appreciate home a little more, even though I have been super lucky to travel to some amazing places and I want to go back, but I also just like her, just like feeling the life of simplicity, especially, you know, having gone to Europe and then a week later going to Detroit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Those are very different. And we had so much fun because it was just my family. And I just remember sitting in that hotel room thinking this is probably our last family vacation. For a while. You know, because
not ever.
The schedules are going to be different. And, you know, hopefully my girls can do what I did with my parents. We vacationed together for 20 some years with our families and our spouses and our all that. But it was so simple. We bought a board game because we forgot to bring games. We bought a board game and sat in the hotel and played it. And we laughed so loud.
Yeah.
It was called "My Family Is So Weird."
No, that's funny.
And it's nice. Like, You have to name your family member of who's most likely to leave potato chip crumbs on the couch.
Yeah.
And then it starts stories and things like that. So I feel like for me, these quotes especially, really, after having just traveled and stuff, kind of came with like, wow.
Yeah. And really, I think that kind of goes profound with like the quote that's right above it on there, the beauty of slowing down, of appreciating the little joys in life rather than missing them while achieving more. You think that ties to the same thing instead of like the go, 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 like take a breath, take a beat.
Take a breath. And it's okay to. I know. I feel like when I was younger, especially, that I liked to travel because I truly was high. It sounds really fast. That I was running from something, that I was running for responsibility, messy house, whatever. I just didn't want to deal with it. And so I have somewhere to go. Sorry. And now I'm more like, okay, not like that anymore.
So. You're just like you just keep like saying more things that connect to other quotes. Cause there's the other quote that's in here that goes with that.
So this book really resonated with me. So
your transitions are top notch today. But the not for the first time, I'm struck that this endeavor was about far, far more than escaping from something. It's heading towards a new life. So that there's a difference between traveling to run away.
Yeah.
And traveling to like experience something.
Right. Which I loved that quote too, because that was Judy. And her initial reason for even joining Pan Am was to run away.
Yeah.
Right.
Literally from her life. Literally. She couldn't just get a divorce easily. Yeah. And I know. I was interested to learn about the Mexican divorce.
Yeah.
Me too. I was like, is that a thing?
Yeah. So here's your glorious transition.
Yes.
And I think actually that Beverly said this to Judy, but it still fits because security is a siren.
Yeah.
Once you have it, it takes a particular kind of courage to detach from its golden leash. And I'm afraid that I haven't. Mm-hmm. And it makes sense. Yes. With Beverly, because she's really referring to a golden leash, but you can take golden out and it's still talking about Judy. You know, I know women who are battered or whatever, that they, the same thing, they feel like, I know what to expect at least.
Right. And if
I don't know what, if I walk, I don't know what.
Yeah. Better the devil you know than the devil you don't know.
Than the devil you don't. Exactly.
And if Judy hadn't had the opportunity or hadn't had a neighbor that was like, let's get you to this interview. Like, let's do this thing. I will help you forge the papers.
Yeah. We love you, Ronelle.
Yeah. Like, if she didn't have that kind of push of like, this might be your only chance and I'm going to help you take it. Mm-hmm. She probably would not have left.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I am so glad just thinking now that Henry died in that crash too, because otherwise he might have gone after Ronelle.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
You know, she was.
I think maybe that's what makes it okay that Beverly died.
Yeah.
She was because protecting. Henry went down with her. It wasn't it wasn't a fruitless death. It was something for the good of her friend, I guess.
Yeah. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And multiple people, really. Because he probably would have gone after Ronelle.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Because that's how he got the info and the intel on where Judy was. So I was just thinking.
Oh, yeah.
But the one quote is because Come Fly With Me was not just a song to me.
I think I put that. Yep.
It was my parents. It was the renewal of something that I had let go of after they died. And it was my salvation when I was hired by Pan Am and could fulfill the promises that I had made to myself to go everywhere he sang about.
Yeah.
And I think that's Judy, because remember, she had
Judy says the album. Yeah.
In her suitcase that she had to leave behind.
Right.
But Ronelle
saves it.
Yeah.
Because the suitcase gets thrown out and Ronelle sees the record and grabs it.
And grabs it.
I forgot that. You're right. Yeah. Yeah. So.
But I love that. I think I put this because I love that she said it's not just a song. It was my parents.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like it's a connection to her life with her parents. And like she says, the renewal of something I let go of after they died.
Yes.
So it was like her permission to go do this.
And that for you, Sarah, too, is you always love when the title of the book is in the book.
I love it. Yeah,
for sure. All right. And places.
So, Oh my gosh. So many places. Well, so much food.
Yes, so much food. We already talked a little bit about the rambutan.
Yes.
Yep.
And then I don't know who put the quote about like the restaurant in Rome built over the room.
I totally did.
Julius Caesar was murdered. I don't know why that made me laugh when I was reading. Like, I don't know that it's meant to be a really funny quote, but the way I read it in my head where she was just like, and the restaurant in Rome built over the ruins where Julius Caesar was murdered. I read it as like a funny line and I was like,
right.
Yeah.
I liked how she pointed, because in addition to just like food, I liked that quote because it was about the place and the food.
Yes.
So for us, you know, the high tea in the Crooked Hotel in Blenheim, England, the butter curry at the stall run by a blind man in the New Delhi Market, the restaurant in Rome built over the ruins where Julius Caesar was murdered. Like, it was the connection of food with the place. Right. And I was like, that's so us. Love it.
And even like, too, going back up here further where we had mojitos and tequila shots and arroz con pollo and boliche, you know, in Miami, which was very exotic, I'm sure, especially for Judy.
Yes.
You know, coming from, you know, BFE in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
So very, very, you know, now that's something that we see all the time, but for her, it was very exotic. And the Kona
coffee, a mojito was not necessarily around in Pennsylvania at the time.
I'm sure not.
So, you know. I know there was a lot more food than this listed. Yeah. We have the bucatini, al carbonara, we have cannoli, Kona coffee, but
I put the Kona coffee down because I went to Hawaii. God, I was like elementary school, like sixth grade, maybe fifth or sixth grade. And I remember my mother became obsessed with Kona coffee.
That's funny.
And we had to try and find it everywhere. Yeah. And when our biggest grocery store finally started carrying it, it was like the happiest day.
Yeah.
Because we spent more time like driving around, like what specialty shop might have
we'll carry it. Yeah.
We're getting it shipped from Hawaii. Like it was like an obsession. I was dying. When I read that, I was like, yes, Kona coffee. That's a real thing. A real thing that people get really hooked on.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like there really wasn't as much food as there could have been for as many locations. I think
a slight mention of things, but I think it was more
about the places.
More about the places, yeah.
The travel and the ability of travel to expand your horizons and about, you know, what we're going to eat in any of the places.
Yeah. So places.
All the places.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I totally had to pull out, after I finished the book, I had to pull up that song too.
Yeah.
I had to listen to it. I was like, no, I need some Frank Sinatra in my life.
Now, the one place is not a Frank Sinatra place that I want to go to, especially living here in Florida. I've never been to Vizcaya, and I really want to go there. I've been to Miami before, but I've never been there. So I really want to go there. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
And go to Hong Kong and have Mr. Chan make me a dress, which I think we talked about in recent reads.
Yeah, we did. Recent reads.
Yep.
As your what you would like.
Yes.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting in terms of the places, just learning about Pan Am's routes.
Yeah.
That it wasn't, you know, it was a whole route that you signed up for and then back.
Yes.
And then, so I
kind of liked that. Like you did. I didn't realize that's how it worked that you got.
And Honolulu, Hong Kong, that was all part of one route, right? But they.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you remember, Hawaii was a state then, but it wasn't in the continental United States. So that would still not be a domestic flight probably.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And I guess I didn't know like that much about Pan Am prior to this.
Right.
But the idea that once you're there for long enough, you bid on where you want to go. So you have a little bit of like opportunity to either repeatedly return to your favorite places or explore new locations. I thought that was really cool.
In 1991 is when they finally ended.
My cousin worked for Pan Am when I was a kid. She was not a stewardess. She worked in the Pan Am building in New York City. I don't know what she did.
Okay.
We lived in Germany because back when I was, you know, back in the Stone Age when I was young, you know, airplanes were, you know, was something, especially international, was not something that the average person could do. And she came to visit us, I think, twice because she could fly with her flight benefits. And she was like, I don't know, I think she was like 16 or 17 years older than me. So like when I was like 4 and 5, she was like this exotic creature that flew on a plane to come see me. And I literally went into my mom's sewing box and got the biggest needle I could find. And I told my mom to pierce my ears like Pat's. And my mom was like, we'll take you someplace to go get it then pierced correctly.
A professional.
Yeah. And that's why my ears got pierced when I was like 4, because my cousin who worked for Pan Am came to visit us. And I just thought she was the bee's knees, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So what about final thoughts? What do you guys think?
I do want to read more of Camille's books for sure. I'm super interested in the Memory of Us? That's the
yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
It would be. Just I liked her writing. I like the style. I thought it moved along well. Definitely will recommend it. I might recommend this one to my in-person book club too, because I think this would be one that
I would love really for my likes. In-person book club to do this one.
So well, do you want to add anything else for your final thoughts?
Yeah.
I plan to read more of her books. Like I said, I want to get my in-person book club to read it and have Camille Zoom with us. I want to read more. Like I said, I want to read more of her books. I'm glad you guys liked it because, you know, I like the fact that that's what I like about my personal book club too, is it gets, you know, the three of us have different tastes in reading, but sometimes we can find something that we all connect with that maybe you guys wouldn't have read it if I hadn't suggested it, or vice versa. Although I'm not sure that I'm ever going to read like the Sasquatch book.
You're not going to read Taken by Bigfoot, Marianne?
I don't think so.
It's only 12 pages.
When I'm ready for a good laugh, I will be reading that.
It's 100%. It's definitely worth it. It's such a short little read. It's definitely worth a like, what am I reading right now?
Like, I'm definitely a mood reader. Like, I feel like I've read a lot of romance lately and I'm kind of over it.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of back to historical fiction right now. Just, I need like standard, I don't know.
And one other thing I want to say, one thing for me for historical fiction, I like it when there is a dual timeline, when there's a present.
Yeah.
Because sometimes you get so bogged down in the historical part that, like for me, I like having that, okay, this is modern. I can relate to this. that I'm not just all World War II or whatever it is. So that's one of the really things I liked about this way this book was written, that there was those, that dual timeline. So you weren't just reading history. It wasn't like you're reading a history book. You know, you're reading somebody's true story. So
That's like when you read the things that we leave unfinished.
Yeah,
it's that same thing. It was like going back and forth in time, but right when almost like your brain needs a break, like this is so heavy, what's happening back in time. Okay, now we got a modern chapter. Yeah. What's going on?
Yeah. So I can what's happening right now?
Take a breather.
I just can't do another World War II book for a while.
Yeah.
I think my book club went on a spree for a while where all we read, we did like six in a row.
Oof.
I read The Nightingale along, like when it first came out. Yeah. Nightingale, we did Sarah's Key, we did Love After, what is it? Before, After, and After, Kate Atkinson. It was like, okay, I've learned about World War II in England, World War II in France, World War II in Germany, World War II in Italy. And I'm like, I can't do this
anymore. Can't do anymore.
I'm done with World War II. So even I was hesitant to read the women.
Yeah.
Well, that's
because
Vietnam,
it was Vietnam, but I was just like, I'm so tired of war. Like,
I need something else.
Broken, you know, I'm like, oh, I can't, but so. All right. Any more?
I don't know about you guys, but you know, I've got a book waiting for me. I started reading Tim Curry's, Vagabond, which is his memoir, and I love Tim Curry. He's like, and I was thinking about it.
I was just looking for a memoir too. I was looking on Audible. I was like, I need a good like nonfiction memoir,
this one's an
autobiography.
It's an arc. It doesn't come out until October.
Okay,
but I was thinking about the fact that he provides the soundtrack to like my generation, but all the way up until like my kids' generation, because he was on the traveling, not the traveling Wilburys, the traveling Thornberries, wasn't it? The book on Nickelodeon. So my kids would know who
Who he is.
He was in Clue. It wasn't just Rocky Horror Picture Show.
That's what I think of him as Clue. Yeah. Like, he was so funny in Clue.
Well, I mean, I love the Rocky Horror Picture Show soundtrack. It's like one of my very favorite soundtracks. So I had one of his albums. I saw him in concert one time many, many moons ago. So I want to go read more of his book. So I've been fun chatting with y'all, but there's books waiting to be read. What do you guys, what books are waiting for you guys?
I have not picked up on a next book. I read, I'm going to point at it above my head. I read Tusk Love, and it's one of those books that I like. I don't know what
you
read.
I have a book hangover.
I'm like, I loved it so much. And there's it. So I've been now listening to and watching Critical Role, the Mighty Nine, which is what this comes from. So it's like a whole story, but it's online. But I think I'm going to pick up Jurassic Park again. Like sometimes when I get into like a book hangover, I go back to something that I, one, know that I'm going to like.
Yeah.
And then two, can kind of like read without putting a whole ton of like time. And like, if I see something else, I can set it down move on to a different book.
Cause you know what's going to happen.
I know what's going to happen. So my friend Will, we did the live yesterday, mentioned Jurassic Park, that he's reading it. And I was like, oh, that's actually a really solid book to just like pick up and read while I'm like waiting for my next book to hit.
Because I was looking at nonfiction stuff, I was thinking about doing Devil in the White City again. Long time since I've read that.
So we just finished talking about Come Fly With Me. And if you've read the book or if you were looking to read the book, it does deal with domestic violence. One of the characters is dealing with that in her life. And if you are dealing with that or you know someone who is, the National Domestic Violence Hotline is 1-800-799-7233 and provides resources that are worth reaching out for if you need them.
Definitely, for sure.
That's a wrap on today's episode. So huge thanks to Camille DeMayo for joining us. It was so much fun diving into your world and hearing that
so
all
much fun.
Behind the scenes magic. Kit missed out.
I know. Did. I will get to hear it when everyone else hears it.
Her research is so good. I love the research part of it, know.
I listen to every single one of our podcasts in my car as I drive around. I'm our biggest fan. And so I will listen to it when everyone else gets to hear it.
All right.
Yeah. And if you haven't already gotten your copy of Come Fly With Me, go grab it. And if you don't have it or your library doesn't have it, please request it from your library. Like I said earlier, we'd love to hear from our patrons.
And if you enjoyed this episode, please head to our profile, check out the other books we've featured so far, including Twilight, Perfect Marriage, Lessons in Chemistry, lots more. And if you're looking for book recommendations, each month we share what books we've read across every genre, so you're bound to find something that you'll want to read.
Yeah, yeah. And don't forget to follow our socials, subscribe to the podcast, and please leave us a review. We want to know what you think.
And if there's a book that we haven't talked about yet, please let us know. If there's one you think we should feature in as a monthly feature, or we should just read so we can talk about it in our monthly. Let us know in the comments. Find us on our socials. Tell us all about it.
Yeah. So until next time, keep reading.
Keep exploring.
And don't forget to pack some snacks.
Oh, yeah.
The end.